Today, we're going to be looking at music, reminiscing a little bit about what we like and also the impact that it's had on our lives. It's just before Christmas and the airwaves are full of songs that we've known for decades. And it's interesting, there's not many songs there which I recognise as being fairly recent. Most of them seem to be from the 70s and the 60s and perhaps the 80s. Slade is the one that always seems to come first. What's that one called? I wish
It Could Be Christmas Every Day, or is that...
No, I meant Merry Christmas, everybody.
It's Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Now, you see, that is showing that we're getting old because we can't even remember the title of the songs. But we want to talk a little bit about music and the inspirations that we've had over the years. And I know Steve is dying to get on his guitar and play us three notes. So I'm going to ask him straight away to do that and give an explanation of what on earth he's talking about.
Right, here we go. Just three notes, but they come out, okay? Are you ready? All right. Okay, just three notes. Well, what's special about those? Well,
I only heard two.
Me too, I only heard two, Steve.
Yeah, okay, there's an octave, okay? Oh. It was an F, then an F, then a B in the middle. Let's not be pedantic about this, but I did say three different notes, did I? I just said three notes. that's blown the suspense and the tension that the music was supposed to suggest, because that's the point of it. That is known as a diminished fifth, which in musical terms, or in cultural terms, was called the devil's interval. So now that we're talking about Christmas, I thought let's get the other side out of the way first. And now that those three notes were the three notes that introduced Black Sabbath to the musical world. Black Sabbath, who have turned out to be extremely influential in the heavy metal genre. Ignore the title. I don't believe they were into it. I think they used the genre as just a way of being different. And the music was actually really good. But those three notes have been known throughout history as the church banned them. The church banned the chord at that form, which is a diminished fifth, also known as a tritone, known as the forbidden chord. I thought this is really interesting. And that forbidden chord, those three notes, you find them in Jimi Hendrix in Purple Haze, in West Side Story, and apparently in some classical pieces, including Tristan and Isolde, was it by Wagner? And I was talking to Paul earlier today about that, and he says, yeah, in the prelude to that particular piece of music, they sort of emphasise this, you know, the diminished fifth, because it never gets resolved. It leads you in a tense state, but it never resolves itself. It never finishes. It sort of leaves you hanging, which is, you can sort of sense that from those three notes. So I find that interesting. I find so interesting about how music can have such an effect on us. You know,
why was it that the church considered it was so wrong, or there was something bad about it?
Because it wasn't tuneful.
It wasn't tuneful.
It was dissonant. Is that the word? Dissonant? Dissonant? Anyway.
Discordant.
You've used up all your credit as a very intelligent person, Steve. Go on and explain a bit more.
So, yeah, so it's just the way that those two notes rub against each other. Don't ask me about the theory, but whatever it is historical fact that they were, it's also known as another word, it had Diabolus in Musica, one of the three words, sort of Latin term for it. Diabolus in Musica was associated with that particular, you know, chord. So, interesting stuff. Nothing to do with Christmas.
One wonders what they would have made of Indian music.
Probably more tuneful. I mean, I'm not qualified to be talking about this, so don't even go there. But I thought what we could do today is talk about our own musical journeys and see if they overlap and see if they strike a chord with anyone out there.
Strike a chord. Oh, very good.
Made that one up on the spot. because as far as I'm concerned, we're of the golden generation musically. You know, for me, music died in the 1980s. I don't know what you think, you know, but I don't think much has been produced since then that is particularly memorable. There have been the odd groups that have stood out, but in general, you know, can you beat the 60s? I don't think you can in terms of pop music and reggae and Tamla and Beatles and rock and just about everything. You know, everything that's good sort of flowed out of the 60s. The 70s, not so much, and perhaps not so much the 80s, but certainly the 60s.
Well, it raises a question, doesn't it? Is that why has everything changed? Why is it that the music of today apparently is so different from the music that we experienced way back in the...
There's a stupid answer to that, is that all the songs have been used up. There's nothing left, but that's totally untrue. You know, someone can come out now with the most incredible song and everyone will think, why didn't I think of those notes in that particular order?
I guess that if you were to look at the number of notes that there are and the number of different keys that there are, the possibilities are almost infinite.
Yeah. And it's not just the notes, it's the timing, isn't it? It's the stress on notes and all sorts. But it's quite fascinating. I did try to do a bit of research, but got my head blown up when I started to think about Pythagoras, who, this ancient Greek philosopher who first started looking into music in terms of something that the universe revolves around. Music and mathematics were his two big things. And he talked about the music of the spheres. And I think what you get out of Greek philosophy is that they all expect things to be perfect and concentric and, you know, nothing sort of jarring. And that's why, you know, they tended to think that, you know, the orbits of the Earth and the Sun and all that were all perfect circles. Everything was perfect. And that's why they thought mathematics and music were what make the universe go round. I mean, we know that that's not true, but that was their observation at the time.
And in terms of the church has had a sort of strange relationship with music over the years, hasn't it? In that if you look at a lot of scripture, there seems to have been a lot about music in the Old Testament and the music that was used in the various services and the worship at the temple and things like that. And then in Revelation, you also get this sense of song going on in heaven almost all the time.
Yep.
And yet the church itself at times, you're the historians, you guys. Isn't there a time when they sort of almost banned music in churches?
Yeah, I believe when Cromwell came, didn't it? What do you call that time? Not after the Reformation, but in a way to go against the excesses of, was it King Charles I and all the frivolity and the licentiousness, they banned a lot of things that gave people pleasure, and I think music was one of them. So I think the church service was very austere in those days. In fact, when you see Reformed churches that sort of spring from that era, they tend to be, I mean, the more extreme Reformed churches don't have any music. If you brought a guitar in, you'd get lynched, wouldn't you? I mean, those churches. But
and prior to that, I mean, a lot of the music had been sort of Gregorian chants and that kind of thing. I mean, I'm talking out of total ignorance here. It's just that a little bit of knowledge is dangerous, isn't it?
But biblically, one thing comes to mind was David, King David, when he was...
Yeah.
He was there to soothe the soul of Saul, wasn't he?
Yeah.
By playing the harp. Was it the harp he was playing?
Yeah.
And he rid him of demons, or I don't know, the way he played really calmed Saul down. And so music obviously has very therapeutic sort of effects on people.
Any thoughts, David, on music from your perspective?
I think the first thing to say is I don't think there's any other art form for me personally that is as transformative or transportative. It can just take you back to a certain point in time, unlike anything else. You know, I can hear a piece of music and suddenly I can remember the year, sometimes the month, sometimes the very week where I was when I first heard that. I don't think there's any other art form that's like that. I think there's something truly profound and mysterious and magical about it. It was it was in Twelfth Night that Shakespeare had one of his characters write, you know, if music be the food of love, play on. And I think there's something deeply romantic. I don't necessarily mean, you know, smoochy romantic, although that certainly comes into it. But I think there's something deeply romantic about music.
Yeah.
That just isn't there in the other art forms as much.
I can hear something on the radio that maybe I haven't heard for years, and it will just conjure up a memory when I first heard it back in maybe the 60s. And I can sort of feel it will transport me to that situation. I remember, it sounds really stupid, when I was 16, I was working in the sweatshop, totally illegal. The bloke was a complete crook. In fact, he said to me, I can't pay you much. So what you do, you sign on first, a doll, sign on the doll, and then come to me and do a few hours and I'll pay you in cash. But he got me climbing on the roof of fixing things on the roof of this sweatshop. And the song that they kept playing was from the Stylistics. I've got no memory of musical lyrics, but anyway, if you played it, I would know what it was. But one particular song, and when we hear it now, I can almost feel how I felt climbing up that ladder, you know, as a 16-year-old. It's like you said, David, it's transformative and transportative, you said, wasn't it? Is that a word?
I did check, actually. It's an adjective. It's many people will say it's actually not a word anymore. It was originally used by Nigel Hawthorne.
Oh, in Yes Minister?
No, not that Nigel Hawthorne, a different Nigel Hawthorne. I don't know if he was a Puritan or something like that. Anyway, wherever he was, let's say somebody in the church.
Yeah.
Do either of you guys have Spotify or Apple Music? Which do you use?
I use Spotify.
Yeah. I use Amazon.
So I don't know whether it's the same, David, with Amazon. But with Spotify, you get if you pay for it, you get a review of the year of what you've used. So just to show you how bonkers this can be, they give you your top five artists of the year. So for your delicatation, number one this year for me was Antonio Vivaldi.
Ooh.
Number two was Barry Manilow. Number three was Cliff Richard. Number four was ABBA.
Oh my goodness.
Number five was Bach. I also listened to 99 different genres.
Wow.
Which I wasn't even aware there were 99 different genres. I think the only genre I didn't listen to, and I wish Joe, my wife, was here because we'd have quite the punch up about this one, was jazz. Which I do think is the devil's music. So
yeah, I love jazz.
I like jazz as well. Yeah.
But going back to your first five, the three in the middle, need some explanation. Barry Manilow, ABBA, and Cliff Richard. I don't know, marked you out as someone who could be seen as a bit of a nerd.
I was so cheesy growing up, and not a lot's changed in the intervening period. I was always different. Like I'm still like this today. I always tend to be the maverick.
Yeah.
So, you know, teenage boys at school, when we used to watch things like Starsky and Hutch, everybody thought the cool dude was Paul Michael Glazer.
Yeah.
Which I prefer David Soul.
Because of the songs he was singing.
Yeah, actually, the first album I ever bought was David Soul's Playing to an Audience of One. There we go. So that shows how cheesy I am.
That's it. That was your first album?
First ever album I bought.
Because mine was Sergeant Pepper.
I'm going to beat you all because I've got an album that was my first album is one that you've probably heard of, but never heard of. It was called In the Wake of Poseidon.
Oh, yeah. King Crimson.
King Crimson.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
I don't know who that is, David. You'll have to elaborate.
Well, King Crimson were one of the early pioneers of prog rock. Right. And they came to the fore when, I don't know if you remember, but after Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones died, the Rolling Stones played a big concert, free concert at Hyde Park, and King Crimson played before them.
Yeah.
And I think they basically blew the Rolling Stones away, didn't they, Steve?
I've seen the video, yeah. That was when Mick Jagger let all the pigeons, was it pigeons? Not pigeons. What do you let? The birds.
Doves.
He let the doves go to symbolise the passing of Brian Jones in some way. But yeah, King Crimson, they played... 21st Century Schizoid Man, and totally did everyone in. And You can see pictures, you can see the film, that people were just transfixed at the virtuosity, which was unheard of. You know, and it was a totally new genre that they created, but the musicianship was so high. They came from very, very sort of talented backgrounds, that group. You know, and I still listen to that stuff, you know.
The thing that made me buy it was, I mean, I was a bit of a music nerd at the time because I used to regularly buy music magazines. And I remember reading a review of In the Wake of Poseidon, and they said this is like a rock version of a classical piece of music by Wagner. And they said just the quality of the recording and the musicianship was so different from anything that anybody had heard before.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've got to listen to that. And I did. And I wasn't disappointed.
No. It had a mixture
of... It was an awesome piece of music.
I think it was that one or the other one, but it actually had the, from the Planet Suite, and they had Mars.
That's right, yeah.
The God of War. Yeah. And just done in such an incredible way. You know, so it's like fusing jazz and rock and classical. But don't particularly just want to talk about King Crimson. Though I must say, I've been following them for years, and they are one of my go-to groups. When I write, I have to listen to jazz. I can't listen to anything with lyrics in it, otherwise the words get into my head. So the other group, I don't know if you heard of this group, David, I doubt it, because they're even more crazy, called Soft Machine. Remember Soft Machine? Soft Machine.
There's a big shake of the head from David.
That wouldn't have come across on the podcast. Apologies.
I was actually talking to David Shepherd because I thought if he's heard of King Crimson. But anyway, so they had a record called Soft Machine Third, and it was a double LP with four sides. And one of the sides, half of it was just backward tapes. You know, it was, to anyone that's never heard it, it was complete, utter craziness. But I've been listening to that, and I remember I used to have iTunes on my computer, and it used to monitor, just like your Spotify does, what I've listened to more and more. And it ran into the hundreds, and I probably listened to that music about 1,000 times, and it helps me to write.
I think this is possibly one of the reasons nobody understands a word that Steve writes.
I can't think of a really straight, clever answer to that one.
I wasn't just into prog rock. There are, David mentioned songs that ring a bell, that sort of echo from the past, and you're immediately taken back to things. One of the songs that does that for me is Something in the Air by Thunderclap Newman.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so evocative of the period.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whenever I hear it, I'm transported back to, I think it's the early 70s.
But when you hear it, do you notice the mistake in the piano playing, in the solo? There's one mistake. And these days, that would not be allowed with modern sort of perfection technique. But I think they must have recorded him in one take. And he was just like a post office worker, wasn't he? The old geezer who played the piano. But at one point, he lost the rhythm very slightly. You had to hear it a few times. And I always listen out for that when I hear that track.
Steve, you are a nerd.
I know. That's why I wanted to cover the subject. You know, for me, music is what gets me out of bed. I mean, it's my biggest relaxation. I've been playing the guitar since I was 15.
Yeah.
In the evening, I just sit there with my acoustic and just play blues and just let it go. And it, for me, you know, it does have an effect on you, music.
Yes, definitely.
Calming effect, and making music as well. If you're creative and you can do that sort of stuff, it just brings something out and sort of frees you up in some way.
Have you guys found that as you've got older that your musical tastes have changed at all, or are they pretty much the same as they were when you were younger?
Well, when I was doing my GCSEs or O-levels, as they were back then, I started off, I couldn't find a final option to do. They did this ridiculous thing of grouping all the humanities subjects together, but you could only choose one. So I couldn't choose both history and geography, which was a pain. And so I ended up with a choice between art and music, and I was hopeless at both of those things, although I adored music. So I thought, well, I can't play guitar, I can't play piano, I'll go and do art. So that lasted 2 weeks in year 10 as it was. Mm. And I moved over because I realized how truly appalling I was at art. And so I moved over to music. And I was even worse at music. But what I do remember about that is that, and I can still remember him, and I can see him now. I can see his face in the classroom. Our music teacher was a guy called Mr. Caldwell, who is probably long since dead. But shout out to you, Mr. Caldwell, if you're not, because you had a massive effect on transforming my life in a positive way. And I walked into that classroom and he just told me to sit down, that he had an old record player on and he was playing this piece of music, which was absolutely sublime. And I was thinking, I can't believe musicians are actually making this sound. This is just something like I've never heard before. I'd not been exposed as a youngster to classical music whatsoever. And it turned out it was a piece of music by Mendelssohn. It was part of what's called the Hebridean Overture, a piece of music that many people will be familiar with called Fingal's Cave. And it was just magical. And I still listen to it to this day. And that really did open up the door for me to classical music. And also to soundtracks as well, to movie soundtracks.
Yes.
So, yeah, massive impact on me.
My musical tastes have not changed one bit. You know, when you look at my Spotify, or when I do some exercises, always to Genesis, Rolling Stones, all the old stuff. There's one or two groups that I would still listen to now.
I just think all music, like all art forms, it's just highly subjective.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to like ABBA, somebody's going to hate ABBA. Somebody's going to love Mozart, somebody's going to hate Mozart. That's just the way we are as human beings. Mm. And I don't think anything is devilish, if you like, apart from jazz, obviously.
yeah.
I'll tell you my favorite jazz story later on, but I don't think anything is. I think music is neutral, and it's what you do with music. And I've got to say something here. If you gave me a choice of being all the things I wanted to be growing up, an astronaut, a footballer, a writer, even a writer, which I love to do, or a musical entertainer, a pop star, call it what you will, I would choose that every time. Yeah. And I'm so incredibly jealous of my wife, Jo, who is probably one of the most talented musicians I've ever met in my life. And, yeah. And seriously, she should be a full-time musician. She is.
Yeah. She was. She, in her own way, she was quite well-known.
But she should be more well-known, Steve. It shows that she's got far more integrity than I have, because she was basically offered a record deal by EMI when she was younger. If I'd been offered the same deal, I would have sold my soul to do that. So, but I just love it. I'm like you, Steve. So I listen to music from morning, noon and night. You know, that's just the way I am as an individual.
Yeah.
I've got friends who don't even listen to music, and I find that really bizarre and strange.
I have to go back to what you just said about Jo, your wife, because those that don't know, we used to run conferences and perhaps still will. And that's where I first met you, David. You and Jo, we met in Shrewsbury, I seem to remember, and had a meal together. And then you came and helped us at our second conference. Once we got to our third conference, Jo had very much become part of the musical side of what we did. And I had such wonderful times with her and me. We just sat at the front and we just sort of made it up as we went along. And she's the only person, the only sort of musical leader, because I've played in a few groups and in churches and places like that, but she's the only person who made me feel totally comfortable, in the sense that she was sensitive to how the atmosphere of the place where she was playing. So she never played the same thing twice. It was always in the music just seemed to be connected to people's expectations or their needs, and I just went along with that. So she led and I followed, and I remember because I used to stand behind her, and she used to have all these hand signs that she put hands behind her back and sort of made trouble. She never told me what they meant. So I knew she was asking me to do certain things, but it was great, you know, and to see that. So I agree, her talent, fantastic. And
it raises an issue, doesn't it? Because we know that with Jo, brilliant musician, but also this lovely heart that comes from her relationship with God. And when we look at a lot of the music we like, one wonders about the source, you know, what's going on in these people's lives. And does that in any way invalidate the music, or does it mean that we shouldn't be listening to it? Because let's face it, most of Sergeant Pepper's, Steve, which was your first album, was probably drug inspired to some extent.
Most of it, yeah, absolutely.
And similar with lots of the music that I love over the years.
That's why the 60s was so great for music, is that most of them were drugged out of their heads. And it just gave them this extra creativity that came into the music. And unfortunately, a lot of the words, I mean, they're not as bad as the words you hear, certainly, you know, the swearing that you hear in music today in certain genres, but it's complete nonsense. In the 60s, they were so high on what they were on. The words, you know, think of like Procol Harum, White Shade of Pale and things like that. It's all complete nonsense. But I'm someone, I think we talked about this before, David Shepherd, is that I'm for the music, but I can never remember the words. Yeah, you know, my wife, Monica, she can sing along to, you hear something on the radio, she knows it perfect.
Yeah. Me,
like la, 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 la. It's always been the music.
Yeah, I'm the same as you, Steve. The words don't register with me, really. It's the melodies that really hit me. Yeah. I remember this specifically. We went to see, Debbie and I went to see Rod Stewart, and his songs are very memorable. And most of the time, the whole of the audience was stood up singing all the words. And I stood there thinking, I haven't got a clue what the words are. And Debbie said, why aren't you singing? I said, I don't know the words. Because they never really hit me at all. It's the melodies that always get me.
Sorry, very quick one, Dave. I know you want to say something, but it follows on from what you just said. Something that happened a few weeks ago. I went to a concert with Monica in the Palladium. And it was a group called the Analogues, who are a fantastic, I wouldn't say tribute band, but they do the Beatles perfectly, note perfect. And what they did, they brought basically a whole orchestra. There's about 12 or 15 of them. And they were going through the studio albums of the Beatles with all the sound effects, you know, everything absolutely perfect. And of course, Monica, we loved the music. And that was the one group that we have in common. But when they started playing She's Leaving Home, I'm sure you know that one from Sergeant Pepper, I have to admit this, and I shouldn't be admitting this on the radio, but I cried nonstop throughout the whole song. And I told Monica afterwards, and she said, yeah, it's a sad song, isn't it? It's about a girl leaving home. I said, no, it wasn't. It wasn't the lyrics. It was the music.
Yes.
The music just brought something back to me, and I just cried throughout the whole song. That's just not me. And so the effect that music can have on you emotionally, even if you're not an emotional person, is just amazing, you know. And that could bring us to, you know, going back to sort of church services and what we call worship music, is that what music can do in the sense of drawing us into God's heart, which is not always something that has come that natural to me. You know, like I said, the Beatles moved me more than maybe some of the music I've heard in churches, but that's just my observations.
Well, this is probably just being sparked off by something you said, but what worries me is that the reaction of an audience to some wonderful music by a band or an orchestra or whatever, probably more so with the pop and the rock genres, is not dissimilar to an awful lot of what I've experienced in certain churches with the worship. That concerned me at one point, and it still does to some extent, in that I'm wondering, you know, what it is that is taking people along, what's carrying them along in the worship services. Is it genuine worship of God, or is it something else that's going on?
Yeah. Well, you can't negate our emotions at all. You know, we are both physically, and we are physical beings and spiritual beings, and we're very emotional beings as well. You know, we can watch a movie and burst into tears. It doesn't mean that, you know, we're doing something, in inverted commas, wrong. It's just the way we are. You know, I cry at E.T., you know, so. And I cry at the music to E.T., written by John Williams. And, I mean, there's something straight away. Steve's gone there talking there about going to see that group and crying because of the music. Now, you listen to a John Williams piece, and immediately you think of maybe Superman or Jurassic Park or Indiana Jones or E.T.
Yeah.
Now, flip that. And think, you know, Schindler's List.
Yes. Yeah.
And how can you not fail to be moved by that kind of piece of music and by the images that you're seeing on the screen? So I think you're completely right, Steve. I don't think there's anything that can move us like that. I think we just embrace the emotionalism of it. And not, David, I don't worry about the emotionalism in the church. I think it depends on your mood at the time. I can go and sing In the Bleak Midwinter, which is probably my favorite carol, and have an emotional reaction to it each time.
Yeah.
There's not too many other carols or even hymns in the church that can move me like that, but there are a few that just resonate with me for one reason or another. And I think it's the same with what we might, which I don't think is a very helpful phrase, but I think we all know what we're talking about. Secular music can do exactly the same.
Yeah.
I just think we embrace it.
Yeah. And football, Steve?
Let's not talk about football.
No, I mean...
That's for another week when my team do better. But.
Just before we started the podcast, I just did point out to Steve that Liverpool beat West Ham 5-1. And there was an awful lot of noise and emotion here in Hereford. I'm not sure that there was much the same in Ilford.
No. but I hope that brings on to something else because, you know, I don't know about you, David Shepherd. I know David Jones and I have probably been to quite a few football matches and seeing what is pretty allied to pure worship. Even in terms of the same gestures you'd see in the church, you'd see on the football ground, and maybe not quite as musical, and certainly not the lyrical content may not be quite as wholesome as in a church. But there was a sense of Liverpool. Okay, you know, I'm sorry, David, to mention Liverpool, but you'll never walk alone. That has emotional sort of a backdrop to it, isn't it? I mean, when they sing that, you don't have to be a Liverpool supporter to feel moved.
I was moved when
in the slightest.
I was moved when they, I think it was a remembrance for what had happened at Hillsborough.
Yeah.
And it was after so many years and there were a lot of people in the ground and they sang You'll Never Walk Alone. And that was one of the most moving things I've ever heard. It was quite incredible.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Yeah,
even as an Evertonian, I would agree with that.
The only song that really is guaranteed to move me is When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. Again, because it's got such a fantastic melody, as well as the words, the two allied together, really, really hits me. But I remember coming home from a retreat, where we were together, David, a few months ago, and in my car listening to music. Now, at this retreat, there was a very accomplished musical group led by Lou Fenningham, and it's all wonderfully professionally done. And I think David agreed with me. We weren't particularly moved by it. I don't know. It just seemed like, I've heard all this before. It's the emotionalism. I'm used to that. I'm used to the reaction of the crowds and everything. When I went home, I put on a piece of music from a group that I remember watching when I was 16, actually going to see them live, always one of my favourites. And when they hit up a song, I was on the motorway and I started worshipping. I had a feeling of God's presence from listening to a secular song that had the most mundane lyrics, but the actual music, the way that the music flowed and the way it built up and the emotionalism in it, somehow sort of chimed with my own emotions. And I just felt like if I didn't have my hands on the wheel, I would have had my hands up in the air, you know, which is something I never do in the church service. But it's just the power of it. And who's to say that God wasn't there, you know, because something in my spirit really stirred and it was the music that did it. Yeah, it's such an interesting thing that whether you're Christian or non-Christian, the fact that we can all be moved.
I think the first time I heard Les Mis, I'd been to something in Wales and I was driving back, a long journey back, and it reached the end of it when, is it this a confession by Valjean, is it? I can't remember.
Yeah, Jean Valjean.
Jean Valjean. And I burst into tears, just couldn't stop crying. And I don't know why. It's just the beauty of the music and also the context of what he was singing brilliant. Yeah,
that moves me, David, every single time.
And does it?
I can't watch Les Mis without bursting into tears, and I know exactly the song you're on about.
Yeah,
and again, I can conjure up the images when you were just talking about it there.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, that's having such a massive impact, as Steve will know, on my writing. So, you know, I'm writing a musical based on the songs of Barry Manilow.
I was going to lead into that one. Now that you're there, but just continue in that vein. And
yeah, so again, this is what music does. So I was in the Lake District last summer, staying in a lodge in Hawkshead, and very small village, Hawkshead, beautiful village for those who know it well in Cumbria. And I was walking regularly up to the church there, St. Michael's, and it just occurred to me, funeral scene here for a story. That was the initial kernel of an idea. And then when I got home in the subsequent weeks, I thought, how about a woman dies and her husband is left alone and the woman is called Mandy, and that's a Barry Manilow song. And from there, the whole thing just took off. So, yeah, and that, again, I think shows in Shakespeare's play, Twelfth Night, which I referred to earlier, those words, if music be the food of love, play on, are spoken by the lovelorn Orsino, who's frustrated in his courtship of Countess Olivia. And he asks for more music because he muses that an excess of music my cure is obsession with love, and of course it has the complete opposite effect. You know, only enhances his love of the woman. So and I've always been like that. I've been always been sort of a hopeless romantic, and that comes through in my writing and also in my love of music. So yeah, absolutely.
So to cut a long story short, you're planning to write a musical based on Barry Manilow songs.
Yeah, and he's doing. I've never seen him in concert, Steve. His was the second album I bought, If I Should Love Again. And he's apparently doing one final hurrah in the UK in 2024. I think he's performing in Manchester, but he's also performing at the London Palladium over several nights. And I think what I'm going to do is come down to London and go and see him at the Palladium, and also go and see the ABBA extravaganza, ABBA Voyage. So, I'm going to have a complete cheese fest over a weekend.
And Cliff Richard, is he in town during that week?
Well, unfortunately, Sir Cliff couldn't make it. So, no, I don't think he's here. Yeah. And I'm a bit like, unlike you, David Shepherd, and Mr. Maltz, I remember every single lyric. Joe always says, how can you remember all these words to all these different songs? Yeah. It's a strange thing, really.
Isn't it? You said earlier you had a funny story to do with jazz.
I should just tell you this one. So, Joe doesn't particularly like classical music apart from Chopin, which again is another link with Barry Manilow.
Was that it was the beginning of Mandy, was it? Was it could it be magic?
Could it be magic, yeah. He wrote up with it because his favourite composer is Chopin, and obviously Chopin wrote a lot of music for piano. Anyway, so Joe loves Chopin. So yeah, so when we were living in Manchester, Joe came home from the hairdressers one day, and she was so excited. She said, "You will not believe what's just happened to me." I said, "Well, what's happened?" Said, "I was sat next to this woman who is the PA for Herbie Hancock."
Wow.
"Who's in town tonight. He's performing at the Bridgewater Hall." And I said, "Herbie who?" I said, "Herbie Hancock, the jazz pianist." I said, "Never heard of him, can't stand jazz music." She said, "Oh, I've got his two front row VIP seats."
Oh, wow.
So I was not enthused at all. So we went along, and I wish I'd taken my Apple earpods, so I could listen to some proper pop music. And I had that discordant music. Oh, and it was just horrific. It was horrific. If there is a hell, it's filled with people who like jazz music.
So is it that you don't like improvisation, or you prefer to have music that you're familiar with that never changes?
Yeah, it's the discordant nature of it that I don't like, Steve.
I think it's modern jazz then that is the problem for you, but because I think if you go back and you listen to some of the more traditional jazz, and certainly from the bands that came from, you know, the black bands that started really from the blues, that was much more accessible, I think, in lots of ways than the music of some of the stuff like Miles Davis and Herbie.
I love Miles Davis. I love the discordant stuff. Miles Davis, John Danko, what's that bloke's name? What's his name now? John Coltrane. That sort of stuff. It's something about being discordant that somehow, because of the randomness of it, it sparks off randomness in me. And so when I'm writing, I'm sure there's a connection. It helps me.
But you listen to, say, something like Grover Washington Jr., and I can pretty much guarantee that you would really like that, David. It's not like modern jazz at all. And I think he did some stuff with Bill Withers. Isn't it interesting that how much you can have a really wide range of music, as David has said, that you like? I tried to put together Debbie, my wife, has done this. She's put together a playlist, and she tried to do a playlist of her top 50, and it ended up with 1,000 songs on it, I think. And I started doing it, and I thought, you know, I just could keep on keeping on. Mm. I've got so many songs. And I think the Stylistics one that you mentioned, Steve, would it have been You Make Me Feel Brand New?
Possibly. That one rings a bell as well. Yeah, I'll see if I can think.
I like all that Motown stuff.
Yeah, I love the Motown.
And I think I told you, I love the, I told Steve the other day, David, a track by the Isley Brothers called That Lady, which is awesome, with the most incredible guitar solo in it. And I said to Steve, the thing was, you don't expect that from soul music, you expect it from rock music. And here was this incredible guitar solo. And I think you listened to it, didn't you, Steve?
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Just amazing you could have such a long guitar solo in, it was a single, wasn't it, that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But they actually get away with that. But, yeah, I'm trying to think of that song now.
And funnily enough, I think as you get older, I think you become less open to more modern forms of music.
Yes, yeah,
whereas
you do.
The younger generation, I think they've gone the opposite way. I think they're far more open. And although I think some of that is because of the cultural influences that we see around us. So my little boy who's 6 at the moment, I've had to do him a separate Christmas playlist than his sister. And he was desperate to have on it the music from the new John Lewis advert, which is Andrea Bocelli singing Festa, Life is a Party. And also you had that incident, was it 18 months ago now? It was featured in the Netflix series Stranger Things, when they played Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill, which is, I mean, I think it's a brilliant song personally, but they played that in the TV series, and you know it climbed to the top of the charts because people young people were streaming it, because who's this lady called Kate Bush? I've been writing a novel in which again a romance novel, you'd be unsurprised to hear, the first words of my novel are I blame Kate Bush. I won't tell you any more than that at the moment, but I mean, I grew up loving Kate Bush, and
yeah, me too. Yeah,
great. And cloud busting. I mean, the whole video around cloud busting, brilliant.
Wuthering Heights, when she was like 17 years old, absolutely amazing. Incredible. She wrote it. She danced on it. She sang on it.
Stunning. Steve.
Anyway, I just found the song, David. Can't give you anything but my love.
Ah, yeah, I know that one.
Yeah. The title of our podcast is Now Everything Changes, and I think, Steve, you had a sense that there were critical times in music where everything changed.
I've mentioned like Sgt. Pepper, that the whole idea of a concept album and songs that sort of tied together and were interesting but with most incredible melodies, and that still lives on. I can still play Sgt. Pepper and it'll be as fresh as anything. But the other thing in the genre that of music that has sort of, let's say, floated my boat in the past, which is sort of heavy rock type music, to think that the heavy guitar riff was invented by David Davis in the Kink song, You've Really Got Me. I don't know if you think of the riff, it only had like 3 guitar chords in it, but he got that heavy guitar sound. They didn't have any technology in those days by actually taking a razor blade to the speaker and actually just sort of slicing a hole in the speaker fabric.
Very rock and roll.
And it gave this sort of heavy sound. And it's a whole genre came out of that act. And he's still around talking about it, you know. And the one I think that David Shepherd's mentioned before, when Elvis came, he changed everything as well. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts on in that area? Things that changed music forever or changed your music?
There are certainly epochs, aren't there? So I think David is right. Elvis came along and, you know, before that it was crooners, wasn't it? You know, it was Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra to some extent as well. Elvis came along and then shook everything. The Beatles did exactly the same. And then obviously in the 70s, you do get this. At the beginning of the 70s, you get people like Bowie. And then later on, we get a lot of pop music and then the reaction to that with punk music as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that an awful lot of people who we think would never get on in a month of Sundays because of their different musical styles and tastes actually now really do give a great deal of credence to groups like ABBA. I even heard the other day that Johnny Rotten was a fan of Cliff Richard, which was just like bizarre, absolutely bizarre.
He couldn't say it at the time, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So yeah. Very interesting. But I think there are epochs, but I don't know whether that's true anymore.
No.
I think you mentioned at the beginning, Steve, didn't you, that sort of you felt that music had died. And yeah, I think a lot of young people would disagree with you, Steve. I think a lot of people would look at the, you know, the 90s and the noughties and say, actually, no, we still think there was an epoch there as well.
Let me give you a really good example of this, because I've been watching these videos of music being deconstructed on YouTube. It's this chap called Phil, who's a music teacher, guitar teacher. And he analysed two songs, one by Aretha Franklin and a live performance. He had this music software that actually analysed the notes that she sang. So he stripped away the piano and just got the vocal track. And he said, this is absolute perfection. Her voice was so perfect that when she hit a note, it stayed. And you could see the waveforms. You can actually see it.
Wow.
And the contrast with, there's this Irish singer. I don't want to mention her name because I don't want to defame her, but this is so typical of our generation now. This is someone who had a reasonable voice, so decides to do a music video of her sort of sitting on a settee or wherever, singing a song, which she could sing perfectly well live. But what they did, and he analysed this, is that it was all fake. She was singing. She was miming. She wasn't singing live. It was mimed, and it was it had the vocal tuning.
Auto-tuning.
Auto-tune. And he said he could see that from the waveform, that they were so much into perfection and anything going wrong, let's use technology to enhance. And he said he could even see from the way she said the words, her use of her tongue, to know that she was miming as well. And I thought, how pathetic. Compare that to Aretha Franklin, who just belted it out, playing piano at the same time and hitting the notes.
Wow, yeah. I would have said the same about Ella Fitzgerald, who
Ella Fitzgerald, apparently had
perfect pitch.
Really, yeah.
And if you listen to her, some of her songs are just gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, she did a thing with Louis Armstrong, didn't she? She recorded some albums with him.
Yeah.
That's known as jazz, David.
we are in danger of sounding like grumpy old men here.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. I'm going to say that for me, I think everything changed in terms of music. I think certainly when you're young, you tend to join a tribe. I like this kind of music. And anybody who likes anything else is a little bit, you know, you can't really like that.
Absolutely.
I remember that one of the first bands I liked was The Hollies, because they sang You Ain't Heavy, You're My Brother.
You're My Brother. Yeah.
And I just loved that song.
Yeah, me too.
But all the guys at school were into heavy rock.
Yeah.
And I almost got to the point where I daredn't say, I like The Hollies.
Yeah.
But then I can remember listening to when Jimi Hendrix died, they released Voodoo Child. And I just listened to it and I thought, I have never heard anything like this before in my life. And I bought it as a single. It was, I think it was on the Track label, which belonged to The Who. Mm. And the guitar work on it was flying from one speaker to another. When I had my headphones on, and it was just the most incredible piece of music I'd ever heard. Mm. And that just opened up my eyes to a whole different genre of music that I would never have touched before.
But there's a lot of snobbery, David, isn't there, about stuff?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
I mean, some of that snobbery, I mean, it looks ridiculous at times. So if you take a song like Dancing Queen by ABBA, if you go on Spotify, it's been streamed over 1 billion times. So, you know, I'm quite happy to be a geek and a cheese man. Not that it's a popularity contest, but as I said earlier on, we like what we like.
Yeah. And I got the same story as David Shepherd with when I was a kid, Bridge Over Troubled Water. I absolutely loved it. I did not love it, but I couldn't tell anyone.
Wow.
You could not tell anyone that you liked it. You would have been a nerd. And
I didn't care, Steve. I was happy to be in bed. Partly because I was good at sport, so I could get away with it. But yeah, you know, so I could be as nerdy as I want because I could still beat people in cross country or in a game of tennis or a game of football. So I was quite happy to be a nerd.
Yeah.
And still am.
We can't finish this podcast without me mentioning my all-time favourite music, which is by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. If I want to go to music, I mean, Steve has his kind of go-to music. My go-to music is Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And it could be any combination, just Crosby and Nash, Crosby, Stills and Nash, or Stills and Young, or whatever it is. All of the music, I just love it.
Did you see that concert on the BBC with Nash and Crosby, the two together with a studio audience, just playing together and just loving each other, the way that they were harmonizing. It's beautiful.
Well, I think it was when I was about, I think it was when I was about 18, I went to see Nash and Graham Nash and Dave Crosby at the Festival Hall in London. And it was right in the middle of the hippie period. And I think I probably had the shortest hair there and everybody else was wearing, you know, hair down and bandanas and things with frilly bits on, and all the girls had long dresses and, you know what it was. And I can remember there's an anti-war song by them. I think it's called Chicago. It might be Ohio. And at the end, the chorus is "No More War." And Graham Nash said, stopped the song in the middle and went, "Now, Graham, David and I are not going to sing anymore unless you sing No More War with us. And you need to join in and really sing, because if you don't, we're going to go off the stage." And we're all singing, got our hands up in the air, going, "No More War." Oh, wow. I almost bought into the hippiedom then.
I had a similar experience at an outdoor festival in Finsbury Park. Remember Tom Robinson?
Oh, yes.
The first gay sort of thing. Anyway, he had one song that said, "Stand up if you're glad to be gay."
That's right, yeah.
We all stood up. We all wanted to be all trendy and with it and everything, you know.
And there was I. Last week we referred to the Nolan principles, and there was I. My first concert was the Nolan Sisters.
I like that kind of music.
Although, interestingly, David, a couple of weeks later, just to give myself a bit more kudos, I did go and see the Boomtown Rats.
Yeah.
What, kudos for the Boomtown Rats, really?
Well, I think at the time. I think it sounds like Rat Trap, and I don't like Mondays.
Yeah. Well, I think we could probably talk for ages on this subject.
I love it. I think it's bonkers, but it's brilliant, beautifully bonkers.
It is beautifully bonkers. And it just kind of shows, really, that we have a rich vein of memories coming from the music that we've listened to over the years.
Yeah.
Just one story before we finish. And it is music related. I had a friend of mine who came from a very strict religious background. They weren't allowed to do anything on a Sunday. So they weren't allowed to cut the lawn or do anything like that. Sunday was definitely a day of rest. But also, he never, ever was allowed to go to the cinema. And he kind of thought it was, you know, that something to do with the devil and whatever. And the first time he went to the cinema, he went and saw The Sound of Music. And he cried all the way through it.
Wow.
Was so overwhelmed by it. And he came out and he said, "What have I been missing? What have I been missing?" And I always remember that story because it changed his life, just going to see The Sound of Music.
This is where we didn't see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, that's lucky you didn't see that one. That was that one passed me by as well.
I think that's beautiful, but and all, it's beautifully tragic story, that, David.
It is, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Because like I look at my children now, and music comes on, they're dancing around the living room, the two of them. So, yeah, I think obviously we have a job as parents to protect our kids, but also not to. There's this lovely phrase from a poem that says we should furnish our minds with beauty.
Mm.
And I think music plays a huge role in that, as do books and movies and even TV programs. They can anyway.
Absolutely. I think that's a good way of ending it, actually, David. That's a lovely thing to say at the end.
Yeah.
Yes, thanks ever so much for listening. Steve Maltz, David Jones and myself have been talking about all things music. And we would love to hear from you about what your thoughts are on music and how it has impacted your life. You can go to saltshakers.com and leave your comments there. We look forward to hearing from you. And in the meantime, see you next week.